Welcome to the Distance to Empty podcast, the podcast where we talk about 200-plus mile ultramarathons. I'm your host, Kevin Goldberg, and I'm here with my co-host, Peter Noyes. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing?
I'm good. I am starting my, what my coach and I are calling my triple-triple, which is 3 weeks of triple-digit mileage. So that's the point I'm at in my build right now. So it's today was my rest day, and I did a whole bunch of nothing, which was really nice. And yeah, weekend full of running. Two long runs tomorrow and two long runs on Sunday.
Wow, so two doubles.
Doubles every day this week except for the rest day on Friday, yeah.
Wow, that's intense.
Yeah, it's been a lot of running. And, you know, there's a time and a place for doubles, and I don't always do them, but I've been incorporating them more into this build-up for Cocodona because I think it's just a good way to get more volume in, and especially for the 200s, really simulate that, like, just kind of always be running mentality.
Makes sense. All right. So who do we have today?
Today's guest is really a legend in the ultra running space. He's been running ultras since 1994. He's racked up over 70 100-mile races, over 14 200-mile races. He's got 128 or so results on ultra signup. And really just has performed at a high level for a very long period of time. I've known him since 2018 when I did my first 200 and had just kind of idolized him in the sport just as a source of knowledge and inspiration. And, you know, anyone who meets him, he leaves a lasting impression on. So I'm really excited to get a bunch of, you know, really good pieces of information and wisdom here in this episode. So without further ado, let's get to our guest, Philip Lowry.
All right. Welcome, Phil, to Distance Empty. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
So to kick things off, can you just give us a bit of a background about yourself, how ultra running came onto your radar, and how your journey has progressed since?
Well, it all started probably back in, I can't remember if it was 1990 or 91. I was in an airport shuttle in Utah. I'd gone there to visit family, and I was coming back to law school where I was at UCLA. And in the shuttle, it came up somehow. We were talking about the mountains and hiking and things, and I was interested in hiking and things of that nature. And it turned out one of the passengers had known a guy who had done the Wasatch 100. And I was like, what's the Wasatch 100? And they said, oh, it's this foot race that goes on all the trails between Kaysville, Utah, all the way down to Heber. And I'm like, no way. And he said, no way. And I'm like, oh, wow. And I'm like, I've got to do that at some point. And I thought it was absolutely crazy. And I found it at the same time terrifying and inspiring. This was in 1991, really before the internet and before people were really talking about ultra running at all. So fast forward a couple of years, I'm in Utah now, taking a job, working for the federal judiciary. And I joined a search and rescue team. And it turns out that a couple of the guys that were on the team were two guys who had actually run the Wasatch 100, Paul Hart and John Mulmer. Paul Hart's a violin maker, lives in Mount Pleasant, Utah now, and John's a retired chemist, lives in the Salt Lake area. And they were wearing these funky little packs made by Ultimate Direction in Rexburg, Idaho, and they were running on the trails instead of hiking when we would go up for our search and rescue rounds up on this mountain above Provo. And they told me all about it and filled my head with all kinds of nasty things in terms of, yeah, you can do it. And I'm like, oh, really? And so they were basically Beelzebub's little arch demons who got into my head and got me to really want to try to run Wasatch. So I started running in 1992. I ran up to the top of Mount Timpanogos and back and couldn't really hike again for 2 weeks because of the anterior tibialis tendonitis it gave me. I was like 26 years old. I'd never really run before. I'd done a lot of mountain biking. I was cardiovascularly fit, but I really hadn't run. So that was a lesson. And then the following year, I did my first Grand Canyon double cross. I had the same thing happen, but this time instead of being 14 miles, it was 42. So making progress, right? And then the same weekend, the following year, I did Wasatch, which was my first organized foot race. Basically, what I would do is I would run from Aspen Grove to Brighton Ski Resort and back 40 miles every Saturday. until Wasatch weekend. And that was how I trained, and that's all I knew.
So wow, that's pretty amazing that you'd never done an organized foot race before, and now you're thrown to the Wasatch 100. I don't think I've ever heard of anyone with a first race quite like that. So it sounds like you had a military background as well. Did that influence running in any way, or really that was like the first running you'd ever done?
That was the first running I'd ever done. I didn't join the military till 14 years later. 12 years later. So I joined in 2007 and I ran Wasatch in 94. So 12 and a half years. And that was a whole another experience based upon my father's prior service. And then he passed on and that inspired me to join while I still could, because that was something I'd always wanted to do. So the military, actually, I came into the military as an older officer, as a JAG officer, a lawyer. But it was interesting because I learned some things from running with really good runners. Not saying that ultra runners aren't really good runners, but they don't really focus on form. So I learned some things. I was at actually Army Airborne School. And I had this young second lieutenant who was a prior sergeant, prior NCO. So he had a lot of experience. He was a very gifted runner. And he saw me run the 2 mile test that we needed to do in order to get through airborne school. And he said, "Sir, you run well, but you run weird." I'm like, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, you cross your arms in front of your chest." And so he gave some pointers. And that was actually the year that I kind of broke out and started getting a lot faster because I started focusing a little bit more on form. So I can say the military did that for me. Plus the fact that I had to do all the cross training to maintain the tests, you know, that they do, the physical fitness tests, to do things like air assault school and airborne school, push-ups and sit-ups and pull-ups and things like that.
So Phil, you've you know, racked up well over 100 ultra distance races, many, many 200 mile finishes, which we'll dive into in depth here. But I'm really curious to see, you know, from your perspective, how have, you know, ultras changed in your view from 1994 to present? And then really curious to hear how you think 200s have changed from, I guess your first one was 2017, or at least first official one was 2017, to, you know, to running them here in 2023, being signed up for them in 2024. So I'd love to hear kind of how you think they changed.
They've changed a lot, I think, because of social media. And it's weird how social media influences things in a lot of different milieus. I just got back from Italy, and there are certain experiences people have there that are influenced a lot by Instagram, like touching certain statues and things that wasn't really a thing before, or it was, but it wasn't as widespread. And I think that so you see long lines where they didn't used to be. And I think ultras are like that too, especially hundreds. I think there's a lot of people who are looking at the 100 as, you know, I want to get that on my bucket list. And so what you've seen is an influx of folks into the 100-mile community that I used to say, and I still do, I still think it's true, there's two different pools from which hundreds draw. There's either the folks who are running marathons and are getting slower and are pretty good runners, but they're getting older, or they just aren't where they want to be, or they want some kind of a different challenge for whatever reason. So they decide they want to push to a 100-miler, maybe a mountain 100, where they want to be out in the woods, as it were. And then you've got the hikers who just get fast. And these are people who have really good trail craft, really good nature craft. They know how to survive. They know what gear to take. They're the people who are usually prepared. And they're not normally the fastest folks, but they certainly are the most prepared. And then so that cohort, you intermingle those with the other cohort, which is kind of the people who are used to running road marathons. And those are the people who get, you know, caught in the thunderstorms and almost die and stuff because they're not very well prepared, or they get lost. That's the other thing. And that's just nature of the beast, right? They're used to being in a really well curated race, and they move into a totally different environment. And I think the internet has affected that tremendously. I'm seeing a lot of folks that are doing mountain hundreds now that I think they're trying to be prepared, and a lot of them are really, you know, working at it. But there's a certain percentage that are just kind of showing up and like, okay, so where's all my flags and where's all my food? You know, that's probably the biggest change I've seen. I remember it really well. It was like, I think it was the 2015 Wasatch finish that I looked around, and for the first time, I didn't recognize more than half the people that were there, and that was an unusual experience. for me, because I'd run the race at that point like 18 times. And like, wow, this is completely different culture now. I mean, there's still a lot of the old original gangsters, right? But there's a lot of new people too. And it's not a bad thing. It's just changed. With respect to the 100 scene, now how that relates to the 200 scene is, what you're seeing is a migration of the folks that are in the 100 scene, moving towards the 200 scene because it's more wild and woolly. It is a lot harder. It's not twice as hard. It's 4 to 8 times as hard, as I'm sure Kevin can tell you. And I've done 7,300s now and 16,200s. And the 200 is just a whole nother country. The training is essentially the same, but the misery is way higher. And I don't know if the 200 scene has changed that much in 7 years since I started doing it. I think it's gotten a lot more popular. Now there's a lottery now for Moab. I remember when I first did Moab, I think I registered for it a couple months before the race. There were still slots. And I remember sitting on top of Mount Timpanogos in like 2007 in Utah and wearing my Wasatch t-shirt and talking to somebody about it. And it was July. And I thought to myself, you know, I better get around to registering for the race, because I haven't done that yet. And registration opened in January. And it's a different world now. And there's a lot more demand for the 200s. So now Candace has opened up this 300 miler, right? And so the question is that push going to continue to go out distance wise? But then you get into another issue, which is it becomes a whole different race. It's more of a multi-day than it is really a unitary. I mean, it's still one distance, one time, right? Okay, I get that. But it takes on a different flavor when you get up to those distances. It's like, you know, interstellar travel versus low Earth orbit, you know, totally different animal. And, you know, you have to plan differently. As you know, having done 200s, Kevin, it's the logistical hurdles are 4 times as hard for a 200 than they are for a 100. 100s one night out, maybe. And now it's like crazy 3 nights out, probably, maybe 4, maybe 5. And that becomes very disorienting when you just have to plan for it. And it's 2 different races at the same time. You've got the front pack, the top 10, 15% that are really only out for 2.5, 3 nights, or even 2 nights. If you look at some of the Tahoe times, that's a totally different experience than being out 4 nights, totally different races. So I don't know if that's a change, but that's just how it's manifesting. And we'll see what happens with these longer distances.
Yeah, you hit on some things there that I often try to drive home and help people understand when they're asking like questions about 200s. The first being that it's not double the length. It's not double the difficulty. It is that like exponential 4 to 8 times harder. You're out there for 3, 4, 5 nights versus 1 and even a hard 100. And that's something that I think until you really experience it, it's really hard to fully appreciate the depth of that. And the other thing there that I really love the way he put it is kind of like interstellar travel versus low Earth orbit, is at what point do these distances become a stage race? Not in title, because like you said, it's one time, one continuous race, but in practice, like more or less sleep wins at some point, right? I'm not sure if that's 300 miles, if it's 400 miles, but you know, at some point, to me at least, it would in practice be a stage race, which I think changes the playing field and the experience. And I think it'll be really interesting to see Candace's new 300 push those limits and get closer to that point.
Yeah, so you mentioned a very important point there, sleep wins. You know, I tell people the difference between a marathon and 100 and a 200 is that a marathon, the limiting factor is your musculature. You know, you're pushing at a certain pace and your body's going to break down. At 100, the limiting factor is your gut. You're pushing at a certain pace and pretty soon you're not going to be able to digest food. And if you go slow, you're not going to make the cutoff. So you can't go slow enough to avoid those two barriers, either the muscular barrier or the gut barrier. In a 200, it's your brain. The brain is going to shut you down. And there's no negotiating with the brain. I mean, you could gut through. I mean, I finished Wasatch 1 year sucking on nothing but lifesavers for the last 40 miles because I was so sick. You could pull it off, but it's not easy. But you can't fight the brain. Ask Von Fahn, who lived in or my wife, both lived in a hallucinatory other world for hours on course at different times, Tahoe and Moab. But they had to be
pretty much rescued or just get on the phone or the InReach and say, go to sleep right now where you are. Go to sleep right now. And I don't, no questions. You're DNFing. Go to sleep. So what happens, because you're fighting your brain, is the folks that are finishing really fast at the 200s are really fit because they can move. Not that fast. I mean, think about it. You can go finish Bigfoot under 60. You're going to be probably in the top five. But that's not super dupa dupa fast. I mean, 60 hours, not compared to a sub 24 Wasatch. So you got to be fit. But you also have to have some genes that let you get through those two nights and maybe two nights plus that with really no sleep. And if you end up in a situation where you end up at night three and you're not fast enough, you're toast. You're going to have to crash if you haven't slept at all the first two nights. And so you're kind of rolling the dice, right? And so it's all this strategy that's going on with respect to how fast I'm going to be. I don't do that. I just go, and when I sleep, I lie down, I sleep for 10 minutes. And I'm blessed with genes that I can just down for 10, up, go. Go for another 4 hours. Down for 10, go. Go up for another 2 hours. Just keep doing that, up and down, up and down, up and down, and just keep moving. And that's one of the reasons I think I've succeeded, not because I'm necessarily that fit. I just have genes that I don't need to sleep that much, and it helps.
Yeah, you made a lot of great points there. Just something we've said before is, yes, sleep's highly personal. Like the 10-minute, 4-hour thing, that just doesn't work for me. I need to have an hour a night. I've tried that 10-minute thing. I just can't do it. So yeah, that's just great continued advice for those listening, is sleep is personal. You just have to figure out what works for you.
Yep.
Yeah. And you know, you're right that it's like a calculated gamble, like it based on your goals and your pace. Like, you know, at Tour de Jeanne this past year, I had my goal was 85 hours. Right. So I was looking at three nights. So I was pacing sleep for three nights, which I know how to do. And like you, I can get by on very little sleep, but when an 85 hour finish turns into a 112 hour finish, all of a sudden the calculations are all off. And you are going to crash hard if you don't pivot. And you know, it's very difficult to catch up and reassess out there. And I guess I don't really have a point to the story except for that, like, if you get sleep wrong, it can be a fatal error. It's very difficult to recover from miscalculated sleep.
Right, right. And some people, like, they'll say, I want to get this much sleep every night. And I've done it once. When I did the virtual Tahoe in 2021 because of the fires, I ran step for step with my wife, and she generally needs sleep every night. And so we did the first night, I think we did 4 hours, second night, 5 hours, third night, 6 hours. And that pushed our time into the high 90s, but I had hardly zero, hallucinations or sleep deprivation zombie walk that I often will experience. Now, I've finished a good, 15, 20 hours beyond where I normally would finish, but I was much better at the finish. It was like, wow, this ain't so bad. I mean, it was bad, but you know what I'm saying? It was a revelation. I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot pacing her. I'll pace her for entire hundreds. We'll just register together and I'll hang with her at her pace. And I've learned, number one, I've learned how the back of the pack often gets trashed by poor race organization. Oh, we're out of everything. Do you want a chip? Which is completely unacceptable, by the way, and it really, really chaps me. I'd never experienced that till I started running with her. I remember one aid station at the Zion 100, not to pick too much on them because I think they do a good job, but one year they really turfed it and all they had was pickle juice. No Coke, no water, no nothing, just pickle juice. But it's a different experience, it's a different way to approach the race. Saying, I'm going to sleep this much every night. The problem is when I do a race, I'm just too amped up. And my body, my brain's going in two different frequencies, and one frequency says shut everything down. But after about 10 minutes, the other side of the brain will wake me up and say, you got to keep going. There's too much anxiety there for me, and that's just how I'm wired. But other people, they can do, like you said, Peter, you can do 4 hours, and you're up and you're ready to go.
Yeah, so maybe bringing it back to specific races, I think you have more experience in the 200 space than anyone I know of, at least. And you've the Triple Crown. What originally drew you to the challenge of doing three of these 200s in a summer, and why doing the challenge three times?
I it's a good question because I never had the desire to do the Grand Slam of ultra running, or for that matter, the Rocky Mountain Slam. Mostly because by the time I figured out that I might want to do it, Hard Rock was, basically Neptune. And so what's the point, you know? And that's why I've advocated for the Rocky Mountain Slam to go away, because it's just basically just going to Vegas now. Are you going to get into Hard Rock? And I know that Ty's changed the rules now and Hard Rock's not required. And there's some purists who feel that that's not appropriate, but those people have guaranteed tickets and so they don't care. So I never was really inspired to do any of those, but every one of the, that's because I think the Grand Slam, several of the races I never cared to do. I didn't want to do Vermont. I didn't want to do Western. The zero desire to ever go to those races. And so, I wasn't ever inspired to do them. As opposed to the triple, which every one of those races was really quite amazing, and they still are. Even with the new crop of 200s coming up, they're still, I mean, Tahoe, Moab, and Bigfoot are just all incredibly different and incredibly stunning in their own respects. And I think the very first time I did it, I failed. I DNF'd at Tahoe. Jill finished. We ran together for a while, and that was the one that she wanted to do. I DNF'd because of I pulled a muscle in my leg. And so I really wanted to finish it. And it's just, I find it to be really inspiring. That being said, this will be my fifth attempt. And it hopefully also, if I succeed, it'll be my fourth triple, this year. But then after that, I'm not going to do it again for a while if I can, just because it can be very all consuming, if that makes sense. And it used to be even worse because it could be better or worse. It used to be worse in the sense that it was spread out over it was spread out over less time. That made it better, but it also made the recoveries a lot harder. I think, Kevin, you did the last short triple, the last tight triple. And that it was crazy town. Jill did it. That was what she did also. She did what we call, I guess, the tight triple, the short triple. It's still really hard. And I think in some respects, it's harder. You have more recovery, but you have more time to stare at your navel and kind of twiddle your thumbs and like, what do I do? What do I do? And you don't want to do anything in between. But, you know, last year I was like, you know, F it. I'm just going to go ahead and do the Wonderland with Jill. She really wanted to do the Wonderland. We did it twice. First time she DNF'd, came back 3 weeks later, she finished it in one go. I don't think that had anything to do with the fact that I got an injury and couldn't do Moab. That injury had been lingering from a parachute jump years and years before and finally just had it. And I blew a disc and had to get surgery. But, you know, that's just the luck of the draw. So it's a really inspiring thing to do it. And I find a lot of joy in being out there and meeting people. You know, Jill's always been a part of that too. She's always been either doing the race or crewing or something like that. And she's made it a lot of fun.
I think, you know, anytime I've seen you out there on the trail during the, you know, Candace's 200s, you've always been, you know, I wouldn't say super present, but super pleasant, you know, just in a good mood and having a good time and giving out like great advice. I remember, I think it was at Bigfoot one year we were, somewhere around the Twin Sisters area, and I was messing around with my feet, and you told me that foot care in the last 50 miles of a 200 is a waste of time.
Yep.
And Phil, I don't think I've touched my feet in the last 50 miles of a 200 mile since, and I've run 6 or 7 of them since that. So, you know, really took that to heart, you know, just your ability to have a good time out there and dole out advice is second to none. And it's good advice. I mean, I really have taken that to heart, and it saved me time in a 200. You know, if you're willing to put up with a little pain and discomfort, then yeah, foot care with 50 miles or less to go is a waste of time. Three triple crowns, you know, Tahoe, Bigfoot, Moab. We ask a lot of people this question. Some people have the answer right on the tip of their tongue. They know it for sure. Some people really struggle with it. So you can kind of make it your own. And if you want to give tidbits from each race, that's fine too. But which of the three is your personal favorite?
It's probably Bigfoot, although don't ask me that question at the finish line. I actually was triggered the other day. We were flying from Seattle down to Palm Springs, and we flew right over White Pass High School and Middle School. And I looked right down the window, and I could see the track. I was like, no, not this soon. It was like, Jill, it's right below us, 15,000 feet down. And Rainier was there. And I'm not looking at Rainier, of course. I'm looking at, oh, look, it's Randall.
you know, big bottle. That's so cute. It's flying above it. But I don't know. Bigfoot has a place in my heart. There's a lot of really good memories at Moab, but that's a lot of it, not just from the race, but my wife and I've gone down there a ton to run in the Needles District and run Island in the Sky and done a lot of things. And so, I mean, Moab's probably a really close second. The problem with Moab, and probably why it's not my favorite, it's just, I think it's super hard logistically because the temperature variations and the weather variations, and you can get cooked and then frozen in the same race. And, you know, you're running across the desert, it's 80 degrees and you've got two puffies in your pack because, you know, the front's coming through in 4 hours and it's going to be 28 degrees in about 6 hours. Right. And that's actually happened. But yeah, it's got to be Bigfoot. The hallucinations of Bigfoot are legendary. And there's certain rituals that Jill and I have too. Like every time we go past the sign for Cussed Hollow, I'll take a selfie. And when I get signal on top of Elk Peak, I'll send it to her and she'll roll her eyes at me like that. You're there again. So I just, Bigfoot's probably it. Lewis River, not been fast enough lately to see it in the daylight, but really love that place. Got to be Bigfoot.
Yeah. Bigfoot's on my list. I haven't been there or done that one. So, yeah, the more I hear about it from everyone talking about it, the more I realize I got to do it. So with the Triple Crown and these 200s, do you have any significant learnings? I know we just talked about some of them that Kevin was sharing, but yeah, what are your just some of the big takeaways, especially from the Triple Crown, trying to do a bunch of these in one summer?
Some of the things have been passed on to me, like Carol Manwaring, who finished Bigfoot back in 2017, the same year I finished it for the first time. She was the one that turned me on to Run Goo. I really believe in run going my feet and doing it. Did she give it to you? My wife's looking at me like. Okay. So Jill's denying this now. Jill, no, you're right. You found out about it from Carol. Okay. Jill's correcting me. She's always correcting me. Anyway. So I picked up some really good tips, but you know, some of the things I've learned just recently, I mean, a lot of it's just basic stuff. Like I'll see people at 200s that are wearing like low cut socks and no gaiters. And I'm like, I learned that was crazy at Wasatch like my fifth time, but this might be their fifth race. And so they haven't learned that yet. And so, you know, it's like all the things that collectively you see on my body when I'm at a race, either wearing it or how I've gotten nutrients or other things are a collective of 30 years of experience. And so you've got to give people grace and time to work through what they need to do. So instead of trying to go through the whole list of things, like, you know, one of the piece of advice I gave to Kevin about his feet, I'd learned that just because I can't remember how many times I've been at Brighton trying to fix my feet, and it was mile 75, and it's like I spent 45 minutes in the aid station screwing around with a toe blister, and it didn't make a whit of difference. And the dressing fell off after 10 miles, and I was in pain, and now I had 15 miles to go. It's like, well, just finish, dude. It's like, okay, good advice, and that's how I learned that. But a few things I've learned, let me just give you the latest things I've learned that I thought have been very helpful. Number one, I really like cherry Coke and chocolate milk, and I've found shelf-stable chocolate milk that I can put in my drop bags. It doesn't need to be refrigerated. It's Dairy Gold old-fashioned, 490 calories in every 12 ounces, and it really settles my tummy, and I put that in my drop bags. I've learned that in the last 2 years. You know, who'd have thunk? Of course, I don't think Dairy Gold made shelf-stable chocolate milk until the last 4 or 5 years, but that's because of ultra-pasteurization. So you're always on the lookout for things, right? The other thing is I've had some blister issues. I'm always looking for a shoe that won't give them to me, but sometimes it happens. And I've learned the importance of if it's getting really bad, go ahead and drain it and tape it down really well. And that way it won't expand. Because once they get a certain amount of fluid in them, they're just going to keep growing because of the mechanical pressure. And they'll grow beyond their borders or where the irritation is just because you're squishing water. And every time you make that step, a micrometer of fluid gets in between those layers of the dermis and just keeps growing and growing. And I remember that happening to me at the Bear 1 year from an old blister I had on my heel at Wasatch. And then it finally popped, and then I was fine for the rest of the race. I didn't dress it or anything, but you tape it down to keep that roof on. And I learned that at Moab, and it worked really, really well for some nasty underfoot blisters that I normally don't get. For some reason, I did. Maybe it was because it was really hot and really dusty, and I don't know. I'm like, how did this happen? This didn't happen to me before, and I've done this race like 5 times or 4 times. Why is this happening to me on the 5th time?
our physiology changes. It could be, you know, whatever. It could be that I'm just getting older, and so maybe the skin's more. That's the other important piece, is when the only constant is change. What worked for you last year, it may not work for you this year, and you better be resilient and be ready to pivot, because otherwise, you know, the impression of failure is setting your expectations at a certain level. And if you just lower them, not saying discard them, not saying don't keep working towards your goal, but don't expect it to be, I'm going to have a joyous time without any pain and listen to 3 audiobooks on AI and learn it all and pass, get 3 credit hours while I'm running Moab. You're crazy. Some people go into it with that attitude, and they get disappointed very quickly, and they get distracted by things. You know, so I'm just making that example up, but I mean, there's all kinds of ways that people think it's going to be great, and it's not. And you just have to be ready to be resilient. And that's probably the most important thing, just based upon 2 things I've learned in the last 2 years, that I've changed my game. I keep changing my game. Just be ready to change your game.
Be ready to change your game. I think that's the best piece of advice for 200s ever. As cliche as it is, and as much as I don't like using, you know, quotes to relate to my life, you know, the everyone has a plan until you get punched in the face, you know, quote is so true for 200s, because it's not going to be all butterflies and rainbows out there. It's going to be very, you know, very little butterflies and rainbows. It's going to be a lot of type 2 fun, where you're going to just need to be constantly pivoting, constantly ready for change and assessing as things go on. So,
yeah. As we say in the Army, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. It's the Army variation on the Mike Tyson saying.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned earlier, you know, some of your best memories, you know, personally for yourself with your wife or during these 200s, you know, if you had to pick out 1 or 2 of like your kind of core memories from these races over the years from 16 200s, what are some of the highlights and or lowlights of those races that you've done?
Okay. So one of the highlights was, and a lowlight at the same time, was the year before at Bigfoot. There had been a change in how the drop bags were going to be distributed. Normally there was one drop bag that would then, there were like 3 or 4 different aid stations where the drop bag would be picked up and then moved to the next aid station. So we'd set our drop bags up accordingly. And, you know, this is what Jill's 3rd Bigfoot. It was my 5th or 4th. And, in terms of either attempts or finishes. And so we had this down to an art, and turns out they changed the policy and hadn't made it into the runner's handbook. And so, when I got to Coldwater, I said, where do I put this drop bag? So it goes in the, goes to the next aid station. I think it was at Lewis River or something. And they said, this isn't going anywhere. They're just taking it back to the finish. I'm like, what? Like, yeah, they're not doing that this year. And I'm like, holy crap. That means that Jill's not going to, and I'm not going to have drop bags at like 4 different aid stations. And some of these are after river crossings where you need dry shoes and stuff. I'm like, I'm resilient enough and fast enough that I could probably deal with that. Okay. Especially now that I know I can start raiding drop bags, where I have just extra stuff that I may or may not need. So my even better if gear I can grab. But Jill, number one, she's not necessarily, no one's going to tell her that. Number one, and number two, she's not going to have necessarily, I mean, she could raid my drop bags and things, but can you imagine just, you know, there's no way I get a hold of her. There's no signal on the Bigfoot course. I mean, that's one of the reasons it's kind of an austere and grand adventure. There's no way I'm just going to call her or text her and say, here's what's going on. And she has an inReach, but she's going to turn it on when she needs it. It's just like not practicable. And I just knew that this was not going to be a positive experience. So I'm worried sick about her. It turns out that she makes it to Lewis River, or she made it to Spencer, I think, made it 110 miles in DNF. And the whole time I'm rooting for her, hoping that I can get done in time so I can crew her at the finish, which is something that I really enjoy doing. I'll usually finish about 20 to 24 hours ahead of her. And so I'll hop in the car and drive to the last 2 aid stations and crew her and also help at the aid station, which I really enjoyed. And so that year she just felt like there's just too much going on. So, and she was also worried about me. So we're both on the course separated by 15 miles. We're sick about each other. And so she thought, I'm just going to go crew Phil. And so she shows up. I found out like above Lewis River that she had DNF'd, Tom Rogozinski, who's a great guy, just said, "Hey, I just want to let you know." He kind of broke it to me gently. Tom knows that I really was worried about her. And I'm like, okay, all right, that's fine. She decided to DNF. And then she shows up at Klickitat. And actually, I think, did you show up at Chain of Lakes or just Klickitat? You were Chain. Anyway, she shows up. I just remember when she showed up at Klickitat, and she got there just before I was about to leave, and she had been driving all over the logging roads up there because she was, her GPS was jacked up. But she showed up, and it was such a joy to see her. It was so awesome. And then she showed up at Twin Sisters, and she gave me a full bowl of Cinnamon Toast Crunch she picked up in town. I was like, this is awesome. It's one of the highlights of our marriage. And also the times that we've seen each other on the course of Bigfoot, you have those in and outs, and we always take a picture together above Mount St. Helens as I'm coming back from Windy Ridge and she's going in. So those are some of the highlights of just really wonderful experiences we've had. Even the time that she was pacing me and broke down crying on a rock because she felt like she wasn't going fast enough to keep up with me. And I'm like, you are. And it's like, no, you're not. No, I'm not. And we still call that crying rock to this day. It's right there at the Grand Staff parking lot, right, what, 6 miles from the finish, 4 miles from the finish, whatever the heck it is. And then the low light would probably be last year at, or 2022 at Moab. I made a video at mile 67. I was having blister issues. My son was crewing me, but he was logistically challenged because he was by himself. And I felt bad because I'd snapped at him at, Indian Creek. Because he wasn't ready. He was asleep and I had to change my pack and I was, you know, all the things, right? Like, I was having just one of those moments. And I made this video and the video is hilarious because I am just dropping F bombs and saying how I'm going to quit this race and I'm going to quit this sport, all these things. And it's funny. The video is like 5 minutes long. It's in the moonlight. It's gorgeous. You can see the 2 6-shooter peaks and you can see everything. And in the video, I talk myself out of DNFing at the island, which is the next aid station, because I know my son's going to be waiting for me up on the ridge, and I don't want to disappoint him. And by the time I got to the ridge, of course, it was evening the next day, and I'm feeling much better about myself. But I remember that was really low. And that was about mile 70 or so. Kevin, you know where that spot is. When you're walking through those stupid washes, and they won't end, and you keep trying to keep your feet dry, it's in the dark, and it's like 31 degrees. I hate that. You've been on the pavements. You've been pounding out miles and going fast. And all of a sudden you're in like the middle of this sand wash. And it's hard to follow the markers. And anyway, and it's freezing. I once tried to sleep and my thermometer went down to 18 degrees under a cottonwood tree. And I said, screw this. I got to keep moving. That was probably a really low spot for me. And also sometimes you feel, I don't know, I've had those, and plus the blisters and everything. But then I figured it all out, right? And as best I could, and it was really great support. So those are probably good examples right there. And you know, it's funny. All of them are influenced by family in some way. Like the fact that I knew my son was going to be waiting for me up on in the Abajo Mountains was really influential to me, just talking myself out of that whole headspace.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing and interesting that when we recall highlights from these races, it's often just centered around simple things like food or seeing a particular person at an aid station. Mm-hmm. I think it just really speaks to how hard these are and how those little things can really, you know, pick you back up.
Oh yeah.
So maybe shifting then a bit to what we were talking about before, can you go into a little bit about your strategy and tactics for how you race, maybe even how your training builds up into that?
I mentioned before that my training for 100 really doesn't differ very much from a 200. I do like to try to do some running, like especially dirt road running where you can get more leg turnover. And so I kind of have to do like before surgery, after surgery, because before surgery, I still don't have full function of my right calf because of the impingement on my L5S1 nerve. I'm getting better. I actually went on a run yesterday and was able to sustain a sub-12 pace on dirt with pretty good confidence. The problem is with only part of my calf working, I have a tendency to roll that ankle a little bit more, but my ankles are so stiff that it's really hard for me to roll an ankle anyway. It's just, I'm blessed with high arches and very stiff lower body, issues. Like my ankles and knees and everything. In some respects, it hurts me, but in this respect, it really helps because it acts as a natural brace. So now I'm just focusing on trying to get some running in, but really focusing on hiking and just rehabilitating from my back issues. And I don't plan on putting in any stellar times this year. But at the same time, since I generally handle a 200 by walking them, I take solace in the fact that maybe it won't be that much different. It's hard to walk that much slower unless you like are really suffering. And a 3 mile per hour, 2.7 mile per hour pace is still pretty stout for a 200. Now you have to build in sleep breaks and everything, and that really cuts down your average time. But I generally try to do a lot of elevation. And this year I'm focusing a little bit more on strength, a little bit less on mileages. But I'm also going for my 100-100s. So I've already done 3 200s since my surgery. Or 3 100s, I'm sorry. And hopefully I'll get a couple more in before I toe the line at Tahoe. And the 100s really help because they refresh my pain experience and remind me of what it can be like. And also give me an automatic gear test and, how are things different post-surgery now? You know, what types of things do I need to manage for? And it might be a little bit of, do you really want to do like that kind of real world testing? You know, you're not in a test bed anymore. You're actually out there running 100, but I seem to recover okay from it, so I'm okay with it. I don't recommend it to hardly anybody. I don't do 100 milers regularly on every 3 to 4 weeks to train for a 200. It's probably not a good idea unless you really are used to it.
So Phil, for these hundreds that you're doing, and you said you're at 74 going for 100. Is that true?
I'm at 89, if you count my 200s. And I've had some conversations, but there's no accrediting body for this, okay? There's the general accepted notion amongst those of us who do 200s that if you do a 200-mile race, even if it's over 200, it only counts as one 100. Carl Meltzer and I have had the conversation about, well, what about when he did the AT? You know, there were certain times where he was doing 100 miles on under a 48-hour block. Should he count those? Carl decided not to. I said, if you want to, you can. No one's going to criticize you for that. Davy Crockett's come up with his own matrix of what he would count, which is it has to be in an organized event and has to be under 48 hours, which is, you know, in many respects kind of random. I like the paradigm of as long as it's verifiable. The only reason you do an organized race is for camaraderie or for verification. But if you do it with a GPS unit and you have some other means to attest that you did it, like I like to post things on Facebook, like every 5 miles, I'll post an update and say, I'm at mile 94 or I'm at mile 72. So I've been doing some of these pickup 100s, mostly on the mountains in the state park right behind my house. But also doing my share of organized ones also, like I'm doing the triple this year. Last year I did 2 200s, and those were my only organized races I did last year, but I did a bunch of pickup 100s. I did 2 200s, and then I did the rest of them were pickup races or pickup runs. And like I said, I'll make sure that I've got multiple GPS units so I can record the distance, and I put them on max accuracy, and I have enough experience with GPS to know that they're going to be, I've tested them against USATF certified courses, and I know they're really, really accurate. And then I can always put them on a map. And I'm going to be launching here fairly soon, as it's kind of coincide with when I reach 100-100, which I suspect will probably be maybe next year, my own 100-100s, which is going to be a crowdsource where anybody who does a 100-miler and they can verify it, they just post their GPX and let everybody take pot shots at them. It's going to be a crowdsource method of saying, we don't think you did it, or we think you did it. That way you're not relying on, for example, a race director to say you did 100, because I can tell you that there's several hundreds I've done that weren't 100, and that's just based upon subsequent technology and the fact that, oh, we revised our course to make it 100. Oops. Like Western States for years was 95 or 91, and then it went to 95, and then I think it finally made it to 100. But that was pre-GPS, and, you know, you give them some grace and you try because they were one of the first ones. So that's kind of where I am right now. I've got 11 to go.
Cool. Yeah. And that was kind of what I was getting at was those, I like you calling them pickup hundreds. Like it's as simple as, you know, heading to the park and shooting hoops at the basketball court, just a pickup game, you know, and that's something I really admire about you. I follow you and I see when you do these pickup hundreds where you literally just go out your front door and run 100 miles. And, you know, for me, I'm not sure, I haven't tried it, so who knows, but I'm not sure I have the sort of motivation or kind of, you know, resilience to do that. I've certainly done fast packing and big mountain adventures where I've hit the 100-mile distance. But I think so far in my life, I sort of need that external motivation or kind of external set of guidelines to like get it done. Were you always kind of that way, or is that something that you've...
No, no. In fact, it's funny you say that. What you just said is what I said to Crockett back in the day when he would do his pickup wonder. He was one of the very first person to do this. He would go to the Grand Canyon and he'd put together a 100-mile course and he would run it. He'd go to Capitol Reef, he'd put together a 100-mile course and he would run it. And that's how he got started with Pony Express. And he's now the director of the Pony Express race, which is a race that I love. And I think he does a great job out there. And that's a true beginner's 100 because he doesn't provide any crew or anything or any aid stations. All he provides is the course, and then you are crewed by your own crew vehicle. And you can be crewed wherever you want along this dirt road in the middle of the West Desert of Utah where there's nobody except the run and maybe some errant deer hunters who are going out to some of those mountains that are really remote out there. So I remember, I said, I don't know how he can do this. And I saw one of his routes that he did in the Grand Canyon. And how he had the mental and physical stamina. Physical, I can understand, but it's the mental stamina. You know, at mile 75, he pops back out on the rim and he goes and gets an ice cream cone at Bright Angel and then he goes back in again. I'm like, dude, how do you do that? So I hear where you're coming from, but I guess I made the decision that I'm going to do that. And I've DNF'd, I've done 8900s or 200s and I've DNF'd two. And one of them was the Bear 100 where I just lost my give a crap. And one of them was Tahoe where I was legitimately, you know, tears on my face, injured and had to drop out at 63. But, and that's, by the way, another highlight. That was a low light. It started out as one of the lowest spots, but then it was a highlight because the next morning I got myself out of bed, threw some ice on my leg and went out and crewed my wife for 3 days with her crew. And that was amazing. And met some great people on the Tahoe course that were working the aid stations. And there were people that I'd known from the 90s who used to come out and run Wasatch, and just a great experience. That so anyway, I digressed a little bit to answer your previous question because that was a meaningful experience. But yeah, it's I just think you set a goal and you go for it, right? And I don't have a time expectation or anything. I'm doing my best and I got 11 to go.
Well, it'll be fun to watch you do those 11 and get to that 100-mile mark. Really cool. Phil, this is the first time I've said this during this podcast, which isn't saying much. We've only been doing it for a few months, but I truly feel like we could talk to you forever and go on and on. Like these stories, it's just super entertaining and super valuable. But you know, out of respect for your time here, I want to get to two more things before we wrap it up. So,
yeah.
You know, in 2020, your wife Jill, who's a badass ultra runner in her own right, we've talked about her a bit already here, was diagnosed with breast cancer. You know, from the outside perspective, from someone who is not following super closely, but, you know, follows you and knows what's going on, it seems like it's only kind of amplified the two of yours' experience and dedication to the sport. And sort of, you know, it's been really admirable watching how you've both navigated your way through it and continue to do what you love. I'm sure it's not as simple as that, but how has that impacted your guys' perspective on the sport and how you participate in it?
I think we look at it as a gift to be able to do it more than anything. I remember very well, we went on an adventure run. One of our favorite runs to do is the circumnavigation in the Grand Tetons. And Jill was scheduled she got a double mastectomy. She got it fairly soon, but then she found out that she needed to go into chemotherapy based upon her diagnostic profile. Okay. It's a formula for all that. It gets complicated, but they basically put you into a matrix and say, yeah, you probably ought to get chemo. And she was very nervous because chemo has a lot of side effects. Some people talk about, yeah, you get sick and you lose your hair, but it also can affect your nerves. It can affect a lot of things. And so she was very, very concerned about that. And I remember we made it to the top of Death Canyon and we're looking over Death Canyon and we were about to go into Alaska base. And she started to cry. She's like, I said, what's the matter? You're doing great. She goes, no, I don't know if I'm going to be able to come back and do this next year, because she didn't know if her nerves were going to work, you know? And it was really a moment of being very grateful for where we were, but also being very uncertain about where our future was going to go. And so she went through chemo, and not only did she go through chemo, but she paced my son and I at the Bear 100, which was his first 100. She paced us like 3 days after her second to last treatment. And then her last treatment, we needed to get done with Moab at a certain hour. I needed to be finished so we could get in the car and drive back to Salt Lake so she could get her last chemo. And so it was something where she was very enlivened by the fact that she was continuing to be part of this whole experience with ultra running. And then the following year, so this would have been 10 months post last chemo appointment, she started the triple in 2021 and she finished it on the day she had her last chemo treatment the year before, the 1 year anniversary of her chemo. So it was a way to say, okay, you know, I don't know what you believe or what you don't, but it was a way to say fuck cancer. And it was basically, you know, do what you got to do to get it done. And she hasn't done an organized race since she DNF'd at Bigfoot. You know, we tried to do Zion and she basically DNF'd at mile 50 saying, you know what, I'm not into this. That was last year. But she's still, I mean, this morning we went on a run and I was having a hard time keeping up with her. So this gives you an idea. She's irrepressible. And she did the Wonderland in one go in 54 hours, unsupported. We had a drop bag at Mowich Lake, but that's the Forest Service provides that. But we had nobody meeting us on the course or anything. So she's still very badass.
Yeah, my wife and I did Wonderland in, I think, 59 hours. And that's a stout time on that. That's a really cool and really awesome to hear.
Yeah. So she's been an inspiration. She's the boobless bomber.
Yeah, that's a definitely inspiring story there. So, yeah, happy to hear that everything seems to be going well and continuing to, you know, enjoy the sport.
Yeah.
So maybe one last question here. So we know you're a director of GPS for Destination Trail.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk to us just a little bit about how that came to be and what exactly that role is?
Yeah, a lot of it was just because Candace had been putting together the maps and everything and been fielding questions from folks on, you know, how do I upload the course into my GPS and things like that. And she just needed some help. And this was at a time when she was really feeling it acutely. Tahoe was looking like it was, Tahoe had just canceled and she just reached out and said, I need some additional help with volunteering on the skills critical areas. And so I said, yeah, I'd be happy to curate the maps and everything. And I still consult to the race on those issues. You know, Garrett will go out in the field or Ryan will go out in the field and they'll make adjustments or do other things like that. But it basically is a way for her to delegate that responsibility to someone who's technically skilled in the area like I am. And I've been doing it for a long time, starting with Wasatch and then doing it for the Casino Mosa 100K and the Snow Peaks 50 and a few other races, the Bear 100. You know, I did all the mapping for Leland back in the day. And so it's a real passion of mine and I really enjoy it. I was already doing it anyway for myself. And she said, well, you're already curating all these maps and these GPX courses. So she felt like I could contribute there. So it's been really enjoyable working with her.
That's awesome. Yeah. It's definitely appreciated too by the runners who do seem to struggle immensely in getting those routes uploaded, and just navigation in general is not always the strong suit of us.
Yeah. Well, the philosophy at Destination Trail is very different from a lot of other hundreds. When I first ran Bigfoot, it was like the best and most flagged route I'd ever done. And I couldn't believe that it was so well flagged for a 200-mile race. And if you look at, you know, the number of dragons, which are the flags, they're called dragons because they have little clothespins on them, like little dragons, how many of them there are. When somebody goes out, they'll have a bandolier full of them, and then they collect them all on the way out. It's a whole nother aspect of race management of just putting the flags up and taking them down. And she would really like to move away from being it so flag dependent, which is why she requires people to have the course on their phone. And the thought was, if I'm going to require people to have the course on their phone, they need to be technologically savvy enough to get the courses on there. And that's where that role came in spades, along with, you know, you don't have your phone, get it onto your Phoenix watch from Garmin or your Coros or whatever. I mean, whatever method you have, please do it. And so she embraced that. And I see that as the future. The two things that cause the government agencies on which we run their lands that cause them the most heartburn is probably flagging, because it is so visible to the public. Unless you actually are on the course when the race is going on and you see all these runners coming towards you and you're trying to go mountain biking, that's one thing. but it's a lot more likely that the flags are out there for 2, 3, 4, or 5 days. People are going to see them and saying, what's up with all this flagging? Why am I seeing flagging in the Aspen? Why am I seeing flagging in my desert? And they don't like it. And the other thing that the agencies would hope that we could get rid of would be crews. I don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon, but that would probably solve 80% of all of our regulatory issues, is how many vehicles are driving on the cryptogamic soil, you know? And I'm not saying that that's going to be something that's going to change. I know in Europe, crews are basically, you know, verboten, but, or very limited, you know. It's one thing that, you know, I know the spine race, for example, you might be able to meet your runner, but you can't really do anything for them. So it's a very American thing, and it's a very, I know it's very family oriented. Wasatch is really big into making the family be a part of it, but cutting down on the flagging, I think, helps. And that means we have to rely more on the tech.
Yeah. Running my first 200 over in Europe was eye opening. It's definitely a different experience with the, in regards to crew and support.
Yeah.
All right, Phil, we end these episodes with sort of a quick five questions, whatever comes to mind.
Okay.
And I'll kick it off here. What's a 200-mile or 200-plus-mile race or route that you've yet to do that is high on your list that you'd love to do?
Tour de Géant. I'd like to try it. And that's or Candace's 300-miler next year. I've probably got my eye on that before I'm going to go over to Europe.
All right. Coolest wildlife encounter you've had on a trail?
A mountain sheep, a male mountain sheep, a billy, that a bighorn in the Grand Canyon that would not get out of my way. And I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to sit here until you decide to move. And that was probably the most interesting. I have seen lions and stuff like that, but this was like, I'm in your face and I don't care. That was probably the most interesting. In the Grand Canyon, doing a double cross.
Nice. What about favorite food for a 200? I think you may have touched on this already.
Yeah, chocolate milk. I mentioned that. Cherry Coke. I always put those in my drop bags too, because regular Coke gets old. Cherry Coke never gets old, especially that first twist off and your first five gulps when you stand in fresh. Woo!
All right. Favorite piece of gear for a 200?
Favorite piece of gear for a 200, that's probably indispensable, would be my Garmin Enduro 2 watch, or watches, because they are absolutely indispensable for making sure that I don't screw things up. And then I also wear it's a cycling jersey, but it's actually designed for running, so it has two front pockets on it too. And I really like those shirts, those long sleeve shirts, and I think it's Raid Life that makes them, and you can't get them anymore, but I have several.
All right. And the last question, I think we all know the answer, but it's the theme of this podcast, so we have to ask it anyway. Have you found your distance to empty yet?
Oh, hell no.
So that was a great chat with Phil. I haven't actually really met him before today, but I've actually received a ton of indirect advice just because, like he was saying, he openly shares, you know, everything he can to all those on the trail. So my good friend Gabe has received a lot of that wisdom, and that was indirectly passed to me. And I think that helped make my Cocodona successful. So,
yeah, Phil's got more hands-on experience than just about anyone I personally know in the ultra space. So it was really cool to dig in there, and I really did feel like we could have just kept going. We could have broke down all 70 of his hundreds and all 14 of his 200s and just kind of really kept going with that. But I'm really happy with the tidbits we did get out of it. And it was a fun episode. Should we dive into a pretty epic performance of the week here?
Yeah, let's do it. So this has been a fun day to follow. Basically, as we're recording, the internet is exploding because Jasmine Paris became the first female to finish the Barkley Marathons. So it was a nail biter, 99 seconds to spare out of a 60-hour race. So this is amazing. I think it's now 20-ish people that have finished overall, and the first female. So this is incredible.
Yeah, it was a wild year to follow Barkley. Five finishers, and yet Jasmine was the 20th finisher overall, and the 20th finisher ever. You know, not overall, and the first female. Just really, really cool stuff. So. It's pretty cool that it was like happening as we're recording here.
Is it that time?
It's everyone's favorite time. Let's get deep. Let's get deep is a card game where Peter and I read each other questions for couples on the podcast. I'll kick us off, Peter. There are three categories: icebreaker, deep, and deeper. For your icebreaker, and I need you to answer in form here, what do you think the coolest accent to have is?
I'm terrible at doing accents, but I think the coolest is Australian. I don't know. I always feel at ease when it doesn't matter what a person's saying in that accent. I feel like it's fine.
But you didn't answer in Australian.
I can't.
All right.
Crikey. There you go. All right. Icebreaker for you. What's your go-to joke or one-liner?
Man, I don't have any, like, all my jokes are like long and super detailed. But you know what? It's our podcast and we can tell jokes however we want. So I'm going to tell my long joke. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. So a guy's driving down the street. He passes a house and he sees a sign out front that says talking dog for sale. He stops, he gets out. He's like, I got to knock on this door and see what this is all about. So he knocks on the door and the guy answers and he says, you have a talking dog for sale? And the homeowner who answered the door is like, oh yeah, he's out in the backyard, you know, super friendly. Head on back and talk to him and, you know, see what you think. And if you like him and you're interested in, you know, buying this dog, just come back and we'll chat. So he goes around to the yard. There's a dog sitting out there. He shouts over the fence. He's like, hey, I hear you can talk. And the dog goes, yeah. And the guy's like, holy crap, like you're a talking dog. Like, what's your story? How'd you learn to talk? And the dog's like, well, I could just always talk. I've had a long, illustrious career. I was a dog for the CIA. I sat over and was a spy and got, you know, valuable intel for the country. And then I came back and worked for the FBI and was part of some of the biggest drug busts in the history of our country. And now I'm retired and I live here in this guy's yard. So the guy's like, all right. I gotta have you. So I'm gonna go buy you from your owner. Walks back around to the door, knocks again. And he's like, your dog's amazing. I want him. How much? The guy goes, $10. And he goes, $10? Why so cheap? And so the guy goes, well, that dog's full of crap. He hasn't done any of that stuff.
That's great. That reminds me of like a Norm MacDonald joke.
Yeah, where the payoff isn't even worth it. It's just that you're like, oh man. So anyway, that's my go-to joke. Hopefully that wasn't too rambling for everyone.
All right.
Where are we? My turn to ask you deep.
Yep.
If you could instantly be fluent in another language, which language would it be and why?
It would be Spanish, just because a lot of my family is fluent in Spanish. So I feel like I'm missing out on not being able to speak in that language. I mean, I know the basics, but I'm terrible at learning languages. I did not pick it up in high school. So Spanish. Okay. Deep for you. What's one of your simple pleasures?
I don't know if it's a simple pleasure, but I really like fly fishing. Yeah. Even if I'm not catching, just standing in a river and passing time is like my favorite thing to do when I'm not running. And then I also read and watch TV like a madman. I'm always reading, always watching TV if I'm not being active. So those are my active simple pleasure and my passive simple pleasures. All right. I'm going to alter this one a little bit for your deeper. The question is, what is your favorite kind of foreplay? But I'm going to take foreplay to mean like day before a race. Like, what's your perfect day before a race? How do you spend it?
Sure. I got a little scared there for a second. Day before a race, I think my triathlon training is just ingrained in my head where it's all the things like stay away from the check-in area, right? Don't just mingle with all the athletes all day. Just get in, get out, get back, you know, plan the meals, keep your feet up, set out all your gear, go over the race plan, sunscreen the night before, then sunscreen again in the morning. Yeah, go get it.
All right. For everyone listening out there, don't sunscreen the night before. Just never sunscreen the night before. It's a super weird thing that Peter does and only Peter does. It's smelly. It's messy. It ruins the sheets in the Airbnb. Just sunscreen the morning of. You'll be fine.
Okay. All right. And then, deeper for you. Do you like surprises? Why or why not?
I do like surprises, but I'm pretty bad at like getting that. Like I'll almost always find out somehow. I don't know how. Maybe I'm Snoopy or whatever it is, but I seem to always ruin my own surprises. But I do like them, yeah. All right, we do not have a snack review for you guys today. I did get a bunch of new goodies in the mail from Galactic Snacks. Peter's waiting on his, so we're going to hold off until next week for that. And, you know, we might do some real food reviews here soon you know, try to make it a little more, like, actionable and tangible for you guys. But we did put out a call for some listener questions, so we want to answer some of your questions here today in this episode. We'll start with Brooke Ultrarunner on Instagram asks, how much running can you actually do with the weight of 5 liters of water in the first 37 of Coca? Peter, you want to share your take on that?
Sure. So, you know, some running, you know, like we talked about in earlier episodes, that it's that 11,000 feet of gain over the 30 miles, not over the 15. So there is a more downhill, more flat than you think. And, you know, you are drinking that. So the amount of that liquid is shrinking as you go. So, you know, I started really conservatively, not that much running. I started off with like 13, 14 minute miles. So a little bit, but yeah, the downhills I was running, the flats I was running in the first 50K.
Yeah. I mean, pretty much same for me. Like, you know, my average time, like, or average pace when I got to Crown King was right around a 15 minute mile. And there were definitely a lot of, like, you know, 20 plus 25 minute miles on the steeper parts of the climb. So that tells me that there were a fair amount of faster miles in there too. There's no like way around it. It's uncomfortable to carry that much, like, in your pack, no matter what pack or setup you have. It's just it's a bit uncomfortable on day one, but you will get through it. And it's, like Peter said, incentive to drink and get rid of those fluids.
Yep. And also remember, the last 4 miles is right after a little aid station. It's all easy downhill. So if you don't blow up getting to that mark, you know, you can do 10 minute miles into Crown King, and that would really bring your average down.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to combine questions here from Clumsy Feet on Instagram and Run Dog Mom Run. So Clumsy Feet said, when do you think it's reasonable to start considering a 200 plus mile? And Run Dog Mom Run said, what's the ideal experience for someone to have running ultras going into their first 200 mile race? So kind of that, like, you know, where do we want to start from? I'll start here and just say, like, I don't know that there is any ideal experience. I mean, we've seen plenty of people go in from more of a hiking background, very little ultra running. I've seen people who have gone 50K to 200. I think it's more the question of, like, how much time do you dedicate to training for the race once you commit to doing one? And obviously, as with just about anything in life, the more experience you have, like, going into it, the more set up for success you'll be. But I don't think it's necessarily a limiting factor of, like, if you want to do it and have the time and the means to do it, then anyone can be successful, you know, if you start today.
Yeah, my take on that one is, I think the best preparation is just put yourself out there, meet people that have done it before, gain as much wisdom from them as you can, and, you know, go on adventures, you know, practicing gear, you know, understanding how all this comes together. And then I think the training is then just the last part, but all those other things will really set you up for success.
All right, let's do two more questions today, and then we'll get to some others in future episodes. So we'll do a serious one and a silly one. This one is from Koth26 on Instagram. As far as crew during a race, if you could have an MD, a PT, or an athletic trainer, or a medic, which would you prefer?
I'd probably go with the athletic trainer. I think that's the person out of all of those that is able to solve problems in the moment more than any of the other ones.
Yeah, I was thinking PT or athletic trainer, probably PT. I feel like, I don't know, from what the people I know who are MDs or medics might be more likely to want you to stop. whereas I think the PT or the athletic trainer would be a little more creative with their problem solving in real time. And, like, yeah, that would be my pick too. All right. Coach Simmons Runs, Andrew Simmons of Lifelong Endurance, former coach of mine, and he's crewed me at two of my 200s. And he's gotten me many of these to eat at my 200s. He asks, how many gas station donuts could you consume in a 200 mile race, donuts per mile? So you know, gas station donuts, pretty vague. If I'm thinking of kind of the one he got me, It's just like your classic, like Homer Simpson's pink frosted donut. If you Google how many calories are in a gas station donut, adaptive AI comes up with about 360 calories per donut, which, you know, if you're really nailing your fueling, that could almost be a donut an hour. So if I'm running Coca-Dona in 70 hours, I'm going to say I can eat 65 gas station donuts during Coca-Dona.
My answer is zero. I've tried donuts in races twice now, and I just have zero desire to eat a donut. I don't know if it's the texture or it's like the cakiness, but yeah, I can't eat a donut.
Oh man, that's a bummer.
Yeah, it's too bad.
All right. Thank you for listening. Hope you guys enjoyed our episode with Phil. We'll catch you next time. As always, if you enjoyed listening, please give us a review. We love reading new reviews, 5 stars if possible, or if that's how you feel. On Apple, you can actually write out a little review. Let us know what you think. Let us know what you want to see on future episodes. Same goes for Instagram. If you guys have questions or have guest recommendations or really anything you want to tell us, we're all ears, and it makes our day when we hear from people. So, yeah, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.